Introducing Lloyd Willard, who is a mechanical engineer by training. He's worked over 20 years in the medical industry, spending several decades studying science and biology, has led to an unusual shift in focus to plant genomics. As chief technology officer of a company involved in GMOs, trait development, his energy has now turned to natural soil regeneration and crop health for the simple reason that soil health, plant health, and human health are inseparable. Lloyd is currently the executive director of the nonprofit organization, The Good Land, and part owner of Creation View Images. CVI uses fixed-wing aircraft and drones with spectral and thermal cameras to collect imagery for later computer analysis. These analyses provide guidance in assessing crop health throughout the growing season for improved management of the soil and crops. Lloyd is passionate about the emergence of restorative agriculture practices which leverage natural soil and air microbiome and the impact that restorative practices can positively improve soil, crop, and ultimately human health. Ladies and gentlemen, Lloyd Willard.
Hi. I've never worn one of these before. I'm talking on behalf of really The Good Land, which is a nonprofit group that I'm involved with. And as I said, I have background with and part ownership in a company that's involved with aerial imagery. So I was invited to talk about that, but I'm going to mesh them a little bit together because his introduction said, you know, I've come to the conclusion from my medical background and my agricultural background that the only way we're going to have an improvement in human health in this country, or across the globe for that matter, is drive right back to the soil. So the producers, the agronomists, the people that are involved with this effort in this organization, you know, are really pioneers. It's a small group. There's, you know, you hear things about no-till, et cetera, and it's starting to get traction across the country. But looking inside that soil food web and the things that are being talked about here, it's a pretty novel group. And I just want to encourage you, and I'm excited about it, and that's one of the reasons I was excited to come and have the opportunity to speak. The nonprofit was called The Good Land, and I'll just give a brief background into that. In the book of Deuteronomy in the Bible, it says, you know, when they come out of Egypt, and he says, well, when you go into the good land that I've given you, the Hebrew words for that are hatov eretz, and so the land is good, and then it's followed by if you do these things, if you stay faithful to me, if you do these things, what will happen is that you will it'll go well with you. So I'm not going to go farther with that topic except to say that in the Hebraic sense, that word good, you know, when we think of the word good, we think out of as what, you know, it smells good, it tastes good, and all these things are true, but the word literally means functional. It's functional. It works together. So, you think of the soil food web, and I'm not going to talk much about it, but I'll be touching up against it here. But you think of the soil food web, and we don't see a lot of it going on as gardeners or producers. We see what's above the ground. But what's underneath the ground, if it's not happening, what's going to happen above the ground? Nada. Nothing. Barren. Right? Nothing. And because it's functional, all the pieces have to connect. And they can connect in such complex ways, but there's simple ways that we can observe them that we can go quite a ways with. You know, I heard a question last session about CEC. And that's a measurement of the mineralization, the biological activity that's going on beneath the ground. And most farmers have never heard of CEC. And you know what? That's all right. They don't necessarily need to, but it's helpful if they understand what mineralization is, because that's what we're working with. As far as questions, what I'll do is I have a lot of slides. I'll try to zip through. I'm trying to present at a kind of a level that will resonate in the middle, not up here, not too scientific, just kind of right in the middle. And at times I'm going to go maybe a little deeper, a little too shallow, but, you know, please bear with me. cation exchange capacity. And it's a, yeah, exactly. And it goes up dramatically with mineralization. The more the microbes, the more the glomalin, the things that are supposed to be in the soil, when they're there, that measurement goes up. So universities have their equipment. They go out, you know, their extension agents, they'll go across fields and they'll help farmers measure it. But what they're getting after is fundamentally how functional that soil is. And I think that's what we're all after, because we all realize we're not going to grow anything if things aren't happening correctly. Okay. All right, I have four parts of the presentation, or really kind of four chapters. One is light, soil, and plants. One is imagery and camera, scouting, and then finally technology and services. Now, I'm not here to sell you anything. This is an interchange in education. So you recognize that top box. That's the simple explanation of photosynthesis, which is not that simple. But it's a start, and we see that involves different reflection and absorption of different light. Okay, and we'll say more about that later. Excuse me. Oh, I told you I wasn't used to wearing one of these. All right, so we'll just start off at a kind of a question. What do all of these have in common? And if you don't know what you're looking at, you're looking at Schroeder playing the piano from the Snoopy's cartoon. Think about not Schroeder, but the music maybe, the sun, the moon, and lightning. Any thoughts? This is kind of, well, you're, that's right. That's right. You want to elaborate?
Well,
yeah. Yeah, you're right. And so just to kind of keep it simple. Here's a little professor, fat boy, and I used to work for Pillsbury, so that's actually the Pillsbury head. I did that when I was in college, but he's moving. He's got the rope tied to a wall, and he's moving his arm up and down. He's creating a sine wave. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever done that? Well, yeah, it's fun, and of course you can create the same frequency. But it depends on how hard you're pulling back and what how much energy you're putting in there. Because what he's doing is just exchanging energy to that rope. And, of course, the second time it'll come back on him. So it resonates back and forth. He can stop and it'll resonate till it loses its frequency. But that simple wave, oh, that's, there you go. Can you guys even see that little dot? That simple shape from here to here is the sine wave. One wave long, and basically we have from here to here is one, and from here to here. So we have about three waves there. And that wave is really so involved in what we live in every day. And it's that simple shape that can be originated by any child and observed, and wow, look what that does. But that waveform is part of life itself and part of everything we do. And I'll just talk about that a little more here. So the answer is all have wave energy in common. That sun, the moon, the piano, they're just different frequencies. And I'll show you this again. Now, the Schroeder over there, he's in the audible range, 20 to about 20,000 hertz. Now, hertz is a cycle a second. So it goes up and it comes back down, and it takes 1 second. So that's a hertz. So when they talk about frequency, they're always talking about some multiple hertz. So a kilohertz would be like 1,000 cycles a second. A megahertz would be 1,000,000 cycles a second, and on up the ladder. So the numbers get so large so fast, they just start using scientific notation, which tells you how many zeros is after that. So 10 to the fourth would be 1 with 4 zeros, or 10,000. So that's what you're seeing on this lower scale. So the sound here, the ear, is in these frequency ranges. And, of course, our frequency ranges, mine wouldn't be the same as maybe somebody younger. It narrows because I've spent too many hours on tractors and behind noisy machines. But, and I won't mention music, which is Schroeder's up to. but it narrows with time, but it doesn't change the frequencies that are considered these bands. Here we have your frequencies that come from lightning. Well, there's two sets of frequencies. We see them with our eyes, don't we? So they're the visual frequencies. There's the audible frequencies, but there's an additional frequency as well. And anybody want to guess what those frequencies are? They're electromagnetic frequencies. And I'll talk about that in a moment. And then the sun, a vast band of frequencies, many orders of magnitude. What is that, about 10 orders of magnitude? And frankly, I think it's probably beyond that. But the amplitude or the amount of it gets pretty small. So here we have the low pitches shown over here in this lower table. They plug in up here. And has anybody heard of ultrasound? I'm sure you probably all have, but any of us that have had children have had that. Well, ultrasound is a relatively low frequency in the whole game of things. And we actually can hear the lower ultrasound frequencies, but ultrasound will go up to all the way up to maybe 100 kilohertz. But the ultrasound is a fairly long wave, and they send it in. It bounces off the child in the placenta, and then they can form a shape with it using the computer construction. Well, these ultrasound frequencies are pretty important in nature. And so now I'm going to go, I'll come back to that point a little bit, but I do, just as a fun thing. Now, you might say, well, why did you bring these two frequencies up? And I believe the next slide, nope, I'm going to go back. Do you know there's actually studies on the low frequencies? And you know, science is great. They investigate so many things, and there's no end to where we can go. You know, there's studies, if you go out on some of the databases, and they found out that plants seem to emit from the root various frequencies. So, for instance, the frequencies down in the range of 60 hertz or 100 hertz, roughly, they'll emit all the way up to about 256 hertz. Now, that's in the area of the piano scale, just to picture. I think the middle of a piano scale, I don't have it here, is about 250, somewhere in there, 248. 440 is A. Yeah. So your voice probably is, what do you suppose, maybe 200 hertz if you took a settling range somewhere in there? Well, plants are actually communicating or sending out sound in that range. And ironically, so are they up in the kilohertz range. Believe it or not, around 20, 25 kilohertz, they're sending out their little whatever they're doing. And another interesting thing is that the microbes themselves have been measured, and they're up in that approximate same range of the ultrasound frequencies, almost exactly what the plants are. And so it can't help but wonder, well, what's that all about? How can that be? What an amazing thing. And nobody can really explain it today. They just kind of have observed it. But now let's talk about lightning. You know, we all believe and observe that lightning could be accompanied by the fixation of nitrogen. You've heard that. Well, why is that? And I won't answer that, but one of the hypotheses is that, and they have proved this with some testing, that the 3 to 30 kilohertz range, that the microbes seem to just get really busy and they start reproducing. Crazy. So we have these various effects that are all tied back to this electromagnetic spectrum that really goes way down to the very bottom. And there's a lot of room in between that we don't understand. You know, these frequencies are there. The atmosphere filters some of them out, but they're there. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of set the foundation here with that a little bit. So, well, we have the electromagnetic fields from the galaxies. We have the electromagnetic fields from the sun. We have the gravitational fields, and that's all something that is hard to link together. Yeah. They're here. Previous speaker was talking about what you know, I didn't mean to get off on this, but Einstein, you know, was trying to figure out how the unified field theory, he was trying to figure out how the electromagnetic spectrum fit together with the light spectrum and the energy of the electromagnetic field. And he called that the unified field theory. And they're still working on it. And he's been gone a while. Next question. So what else do all these have in common, this time in terms of agriculture? And a little, I almost felt like I put this slide in out of place, but I'm going to talk to it anyway. There's additional studies where they've found that certain frequencies cause rapid germination. So there's quite a bit of work being done to understand why that is true, because it is observable. So for instance, if seeds are germinated in a tall manner or the normal way in your chamber, and you add ultrasound frequencies to them, they germinate faster. But interesting, you get a similar phenomena even in the voices. So you ever heard of people singing to their plants or, you know, turning on radios in their greenhouses, and they swear they see different effects? They might. They very well might. But that science of explaining why that's true is at best in its infancy. But that doesn't mean we don't have to understand it, or we have to understand it to use it if we want to. So if we want to turn on a radio in our greenhouse because we get better effects with Bach, go for it. You're probably not hurting your plant. You might end up proving something that can't be explained scientifically yet. Okay, well, here's the bands that we tend to talk about for agriculture, particularly the bands involved in photosynthesis, the visual spectrum. It's a relatively narrow spectrum, but the spectrum that we see with our eyes is much, much narrower than that. And so we go from the near IR, you know, all the way up to the... To the blues, the blacks, where it gets non-visible. And I'll talk about that shortly here. All right, well, here's the whole spectrum again. And if you can see that, the area that we tend to be able to see, now, in the case, because as frequency increases, the wavelength decreases. So they tend to look backwards. But we tend to be able to see with our eye down into the blues and up into the reds, but not into the near IR. That kind of disappears, but the crops are being impacted from it. Okay, just a little bit of basics. We'll just talk about the sun for a minute. Now this is bare ground. Okay, so think about radiation, and when the sun shines, and that light hits something, what's it do? Well, very simply, it's either absorbed or it's reflected. And that's absorbed is transmitted into the material in some other way. Usually we think about it as just heat. And that's the normal freshman answer when you're studying physics, or even freshman high school probably. Oh, it's absorbed as heat. And that's about as far as I'm going to take it for now, except that we do know that biologically there's a lot more going on than heat. There's molecules just dancing down there, and microbes just doing things. But one thing that we do know is too much heat for the ground is a really bad thing if we're trying to grow some things. Now, microbes specifically, and I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but microbes do not like to be more than about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you touch that soil, you're out there on it, and you touch that soil, and it's hot to the touch of your hand. Your microbes are still alive in your fungi, but they're going dormant. They're not fixing any nutrients for you. Really, the upper bounds is in about 90 Fahrenheit. So you want to keep your ground cool. You know, that's the kind of thing we know. So, but what does our eye see? Why do we see color? You know, why don't we see all of this? And the answer is we see what was not absorbed. So the structure of that soil has a color that is reflected, or a group of colors, and our eyes put it together. But what's left there is what's absorbed, and that's actually the part that's doing the growing for us. The reflected we're seeing. So we look at, I think I'll save that thought just a little longer. Okay. Now, just as an example, here's a bare ground field that was flown with an airplane. This is just a normal high-definition color camera that took this photo. Now, as far as color consistency, what do you see? It's all over the place, right? Yeah, patches. And so we see things here and here and here. They're very different here and from there, and it's all over the place. How many have seen your, or who, I should say, with a show of hands, who have seen your land from the top side or other people's land? Okay, so almost everybody in here. And you notice as soon as you get up in an airplane or with a drone, you see a lot of detail you didn't know was there. We had an agronomist that we worked with that we showed images of one of his fields. He'd seen them for the first time. The farmer hired us. And he said, I had no idea. He'd never been in an airplane. He'd never been in an airplane. And when he saw what was in field, he said, oh, my gosh, I get up on the back of my Honda, and I look across the field. I don't want to take it in too far. And he said, I don't see any of that. Well, you know, you've all seen things from the air, and you know that there's vast variation, almost meter to meter, but certainly area by area. So these areas here, for scale, there's a farm. This was probably flown at about a mile almost. And here you see over here an area pretty light colored and going in, what do you suppose, maybe less than 100 yards, you see a very different coloration of soil. Now, these are useful. Now, what you're seeing there, anybody have any guesses what these lines are? It's a good guess, but it's not it. Yep, those are tile. And this was taken 2 days after a rain, a light rain, and it really contrasts. But we showed this to some university staff in agronomy up at North Dakota State University, and they couldn't believe it. They said, there's tile lines all over North Dakota we don't have any maps of. We didn't know you could see that. They said, what kind of camera is that? And I said, well, about like the one he's holding there. Pretty much. It was a high definition, probably about 12 megapixel. It's a fancier version of it at that point. But what you're seeing here, for instance, anybody want to guess what that is? I'm pointing right there. It's a broken tile line. See? And the water had not gotten into the tile line, so it was still darker and wetter. And probably if we flew it again, we'd find out that the soil structure was quite different as well. So the bare ground is, even that, when you understand the light and absorption, it begins to give you clues. Now, another clue that this doesn't provide you is if you can see the temperature of the soil. That's very useful because relative to itself. So, for instance, if I had the temperature of the soil here, I'm very jittery, sorry, compared to here, that could be useful information for me. And I'll talk about that a little later. Now I'm going to talk about this. This is called a Munsell color chart. And there's pages and pages and pages of these charts. And they're to match the type of soil that you have. Some of them even are made with little circles, so you can set them down on the ground. And you can match the type of soil that you have with the chart. And it'll say, okay, this is this type of clay. There's many, many pages of this. But in a sense, that's what you're seeing from the air, is you're seeing the color variations. Now, in fairness, from the air, you have differences in light, so you're comparing it to itself. It's not an automatic adjustment to the light spectrum, but it gives you a pretty good idea that where your soil is the darkest, where it's the lightest, where it maybe is not draining, and it's a very useful tool. All right. Now I'm going to talk about plants a little bit. Okay. Well, this is one of the three cycles that become pretty important, and this is a transpiration cycle. Now, transpiration is essentially the plant is giving off gases and giving off humidity, and it cools itself, and that process is bringing the minerals up to the body of the plant and up to the leaves. So it's really the lungs of the plant. Now, the transpiration system is fed by the water. Now, this little comment here says it all comes from the rain, but if, you know, it's coming off the water table too, which came from the rain. But the precipitation is the ground has evaporation, and of course the plants do. So that's one of the key elements we'll talk about. So the inputs that plant is getting that help dry that is, of course, the energy from the sun up there. It's getting the precipitation, and of course it's getting the air, and then of course the soil underneath is a big part of what's driving that. So I'll give you a little more first before I go into this. The next part of the cycle is the respiration cycle, and here is where photosynthesis is involved. You know, it's taking on the carbon dioxide, it's fixing carbon in the form of sugars down into the roots. It puts off the root exudates, the sugars that feed the microbes. You have the breaking down of the litter, and you have the giving off of carbon dioxide by the plant leaves and the decaying roots. And of course, the microbes. The microbes respire too. They breathe in and they take out. Now, this important cycle, and I'll give you one more here. Now, this, of course, is a nutrient cycle, it's definitely a simplification of it. But if you take away any of these three components, your plant's not going to be growing. It's like, you know, unplugging the circuit breaker on any of those three. Which one do you think is going to be the easiest one to detect the earliest? Show of hands. The respiration cycle? I'll give you the choices. The respiration cycle, I'll let you look at them quick again here. The transpiration cycle or the nutrient cycle? You're correct. What did I hear? Transpiration or respiration? Which one is going to be if something's not working well and the plant's degenerating, which one is going to be the easiest to detect the earliest? So that was kind of long. Transpiration, respiration, or nutrient? That's correct. If you said transpiration, you're correct. And we can't see it with our eye as far as that early detection. So what happens is the plant says, I'm in trouble. I don't like what's happening. You've all seen the soybean leaves turn over. You know, they'll start to curl a little bit and they turn over. But even before they do that, their temperature goes up. And so if you could, like, put a thermometer on a soybean plant and you knew that it was a little too dry and you watch it react, what you'd find out is even before those leaves started turning over, if you were right there to watch it, that its temperature is going up and it's trying to protect itself. So if you think of the implications of that, you've already got your inputs fixed. I mean, you're talking about your garden, a spot that you don't, you know, you can't live in every spot every moment. So you're not able to watch the changes in the nutrient cycle, which are happening at millisecond speed. You're not able to watch the respiration cycle unless you put something on top of that plant and measure the carbon dioxide respiration. But what you can do is you can watch the transpiration process. I'll tell you how. Because it's temperature-based, it's giving off essentially frequency, just like everything's a wave. It's giving off a frequency that it's radiating. So have you guys, I'm sure you've all heard of night vision goggles. Well, the reason they work is because I'm warmer than the atmosphere. So if somebody's wanting to watch me walk through the woods at night or see if a deer's out there, whatever use of it, because I'm about 99 degrees Fahrenheit and the air is cooler or warmer, I'll stand out. So I'm radiating, and it's got a sensor that's picking up that radiation. So we're all radiating to each other, and the plants are too, every last one of them. And so if you compare a plant to the plants next to it, say you're able to look at a bigger area, an acre or a half an acre or 100 acres, you'll find out that there's a color variation. But the color variation when plants get stressed becomes really, really pronounced. And so if you have a camera that can pick up that thermal response, essentially equivalent. It's called a radiometer, is what they actually call them, but it's picking up that long wave radiation that we emit. If you pick that up, you can see signs of degeneration of that crop much earlier. Okay, so I'll explain a little more on that going forward. But also on the respiration cycle, we talked about that. And here we see that from about 400 to 600 nanometers. Now, a nanometer is a millionth, or a billionth, excuse me, no, 10 to the minus ninth meters long. So 0.00 with nine in ninth place is a one. But the part of the spectrum that we're so acquainted with is the part that we see, which is really this 400 to 700 nanometer range. Now, these units can get confusing, and they will. So just let's put it this way. There's a part of the light spectrum that our eyes are used to looking at every single day, and it's making up the colors we see. But on the outside of that light cycle, and within that, you see the edges of the photosynthesis. You see that something called chlorophyll B is absorbing light over here in the 500 nanometer range, roughly. And chlorophyll A, which tends to be the main one, is absorbing light in the, particularly the blues and the reds, in the about 650 nanometer range. Those are the ranges our eyes can see. So it looks green to us. And when that light absorption starts to shift, because something's wrong with the plant, we know that the plant cycle of the nutrient the nutrients being brought up and the photosynthesis is suffering, so then things change. But they don't change immediately. It might take 2 days, 3 days before you start seeing the difference between a healthy plant and a wilted plant. So if some disease gets on it, aphids or something's at it from the roots, we're not going to see it right away, but it's better to see it as soon as you can, you know. And that's where some of these technologies come together. Okay, here's another scale. And I talked about we're way down here where we're looking at things where chlorophyll's being fixed. But there's a lot of things being fixed outside of that. And these extended cameras, now right here is something called the red edge. See, this red reflection goes straight up. And red edge is an indicator also of interruptions that are occurring in the plant's water cycle. And then way over here, you start to see greater absorptions at certain wavelengths. But generally, you're not going to see data from cameras, anything beyond this red edge point. In the Landsat, which are the NASA cameras, you can see a little bit of it. The resolutions aren't very good, but you can see a little bit of the red edge data. And over here, that's where a lot of science is working right now with multi-spectrum cameras. They're trying to broaden out the spectrum and try to pick up some things that are way over here. But one of the things that is really going to be a challenge is that the reflectivity does not bounce much. So they're looking at it from the sky, and they're trying to figure out, from the satellites even, and they're trying to figure out a change in reflectivity of 2 or 3% that indicate the change. It's quite a challenge. It'll come, though. It'll come, and that's in the future. But what is there today is the visible data that spans the RGB spectrum that we typically pick up with our eyes, and then the red edge. Okay, well, I'm going to talk about cameras and imaging the next section. That camera there on the right is a really interesting company, and I think you'll run across it. It's ICI in Texas. I forget what their whole acronym means. But they make thermal and infrared, near-infrared cameras. But they're really getting traction. This particular camera that's shown is one that we own, and it is a thermal camera, so that long-wave radiation that we look at for the crop health early indicator. That camera was not available to the public until about 5 years ago, and it was within NASA, and it was on the Mars probe. is one of the places. But now they're putting on airplanes because they can see right through fog, et cetera, and they're out in the public domain. But these type of technologies that are trickling out there are really going to change the way that, that things are done. That camera probably has dropped by a factor of 100 in the last 5, 6, 7 years. And you know how technology goes. You know, it once it starts dropping. So I think we may see the day where cameras like that would be available to even people that were home drone enthusiasts. But on the left, you see a thermal image here. And that's the first one you'll see. I'll show you more later, so I'm not going to go into too much detail. But what you're looking at is really what comes into the image is data. You know, you have essentially a matrix of numbers that are assigned to each individual area that's a pixel, that's a location on your picture. So up here, you know, is you know, one, maybe 5 pixels or something, that little area I'm talking about, and each have their individual data, and then it's reconstructed with and assigned colors to it that make sense to us. So we can just quickly look at it, and we can say, you know, I've assigned red to the hotter areas, I've created the band, and the cooler areas are the dark green. And so that's how they're used. All right, now these are the bands that are available on the from NASA. And of the data that you might buy or get from your NRCS or your ASCAS agent, some of this is off of these bands. It's primarily going to be the RGB, the near-IR, some of it's available. But the long-wave stuff here, that's not available. There, it went down on their satellites. But the resolutions will be very long or very, very large on that, which means one pixel may be like 30 meters, which doesn't do you a lot of good. Some of the other ones are a foot, which is pretty good. And the reason I mention that is to most everybody, these things are available at very little cost, and it's a great starting point to know your field. All right. This is essentially a reconstruction of a couple of images, and you can see certain things when you use a camera that your eye cannot really pick up very well, especially when you start assigning colors to them. And so here you see areas that are labeled. They're labeled wet or they're labeled compaction, which we all care a great deal about. They're labeled drain tiles, even tile breaks at places. And now this field was scouted. Now that's a very important part here. Fields should be scouted. By that, I mean that you're going out and you're physically looking at what it is you thought you saw. In some cases, you don't have to look too hard because you can see there's a tree and there's a tree there and you're not worried about it. But in other cases, you're seeing something that you don't like. Like over here, there's a white spot, which is a sign to it. It shows there's no vegetation. And it also has colors assigned in the thermal, perhaps, that show that it's hot. And you're saying, well, why do I have this hot spot in the middle of my field? And one might say, well, that's a sandy knoll. I know that field. And that could be. You know, it could be that, and it could be something else. So it's important to know your field and go out and see what you have. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, I have talked about the imagery some, and I'll show you some actual images. But in short, there's really three major families of cameras, whether they're broad spectral or they're narrower spectrum, like in the RGB, the areas our eyes see are a little into the near IR. But they're high-resolution color cameras, basically. And they're digital, so the data is something that can be deconvoluted out of the data. By that I mean you separate the algorithms the camera's trying to put in it to make it look like the manufacturer wants to look, and then you reconstruct it. And so that's where the digital is really such a benefit, and the thermal and the shortwave infrared. And there's also elevation cameras that are available as well, where they fly across the land. It's a visual image, and they raster back and forth, and it can help show the elevation. And you really have the ability with them to do, regardless of where they come from. I see this isn't a very good slide, but it can be carried a number of different ways: satellite, airplane, drone, hand, pigeon. Yep, got a smart pigeon. Better trust him. And you can look at the image directly, or you can build an algorithm, and so it really, this technologies don't really come down to the carrier. they come down to the technology coming in from the cameras themselves. And as we all know, the cameras are changing so rapidly. It's really a wonderful time in technology, because if you can't find it today, just wait. Yeah. We're heading toward. That's a great question. If I use these words a little loosely sometimes, but an algorithm is to take the data and create your own mathematics and say, I want it to be presented in a certain way. So I assign a color or some other weighting to the system. So for instance, if I look at you and I say, I have this picture, but I think I'd rather look at him lighter or darker skinned or a little yellow hue, you can assign and weight those colors and turn the person into a different shade. Well, you do that with the plants because it helps the eye. The data is what it is. You're not changing the data, and that's very important because you can always go back and reconstruct it another way. So they have these algorithms that are used for vegetation indexes, et cetera, to show, you know, how much vegetation is in that field and the value of it. So, you know, if I look across my field and I see, well, that field over, well, especially for an airplane, that field is dark green over there, and down over here it gets kind of light. You know, we all know most things we'd like it to be dark green. The leaves on it, we can emphasize one over the other so it comes out to the eye better, so we can identify it. But so to your question, that is where these indexes move. And they'll continue to, because there's no end to the number of algorithms that are out there. I got an article from a professor at the University of Minnesota that was a pioneer in a lot of this that he sent, and it was 20 years of progress. There were 40 vegetation indexes where they took various parts of the spectrum and they used it to predict things. But the main one that's used in agriculture today is something called an NDVI, Normal Digital Vegetation Index. And then there's other ones that are different. We actually used a different one that we created, which we found more available or valuable. But they're out there, and they're all useful. They're all useful. Yeah, go ahead.
Are you familiar with Phil Callahan's assessment of insect
spectrum? No. Go ahead, if you want to share it quickly.
I'm just wondering how close we are to being able to get
insects to use the crop. Yeah, I'm not familiar with it. That's a great question. That's a wonderful topic. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So, I'm just wondering how close we might be with some of this new technology to be able to see an actual insect's view of a plant.
Can't answer that. But I do know the topic now that you explain it, and it's a great one. It kind of circles back to some of these other things I just mentioned in the beginning of these frequencies that are involved. You know, the plant emits its frequencies, apparently, that causes bugs to stay away or come and call them. It's a very interesting subject. I'm going to keep moving. I was just told my time's getting shorter than I realized. So this is a drone view. And can you shut these front lights off for me just quickly? Kind of hard to see, but this is an image that was given from me from somebody we do business with in Parker's Prairie. He's an agronomist, and he has his own drones, and we flew the airplanes for them. But if you look very closely, and one of the things I said, drone views can be kind of daunting, aren't they? They can be used. But what you're looking at is more meaningful than what might appear. This is a potato field that is full of rhizoctonia. It's really in trouble. And it's in the moderate stages. I know this field, and it really tanked shortly after he took this picture. So we look at these pictures, and there's value in them if you look at the change in the tones. So even without a thermal, I would go to some of these locations. I'd pick out three or four, and I'd say, I'm going to go see what's going on. I'll explain a little more of that later.
Is that a
yeah, that was a... It's actually more predominant in the compacted areas. Yeah. Well, let me skip ahead a little bit because I'm going to talk to that in a minute. Okay, here's another visual image of, and you see the stark differences in the soil structure. And this one was taken from 5,000 feet. Now, here's a thermal image next to an algorithm image. So the one on the right is something called an ADVI, and the one on the left, and the one on the right, you can see they're coarser pictures because the resolution isn't as good. It's about a meter versus a foot. And so you're looking at two different things. This is actually two different fields here, but that's kind of the difference in the fields. But even within that, again, look at the differences in the vegetation index. And there's going to be a reason for that. It's going to mirror your bare ground image that you take at the beginning of the year. That actually is your best indicator of crop yield, is that bare ground image, believe it or not. This is one of my fields that I own on my farm. And I chose this as a case study. But you see these areas here. Now my ground and the other images will show you. And the purpose of this is not so much analysis, but to show you what you can get for free and the things that you may decide you want to buy or not, but that's coming in the value. Now, this is a Google Earth image, so it doesn't get any freer than that. Almost everybody can get a hold of those if they have a computer or grandchild or somebody that wants to mess with it. So you see the color structure, even with that Google Earth image, that field varies vastly, and I'll show you why in a minute. Okay, now this is, you can get a lot of government imagery. This is kind of the same image. Now this I got from the county. Douglas County, Minnesota is where I live. And you see those same areas, those dark areas here and the light areas. And I want you to just kind of follow these areas as we go through the PowerPoint. This field was put into soybeans. But what you see, now this is a elevation image. And I know you can't read the numbers, but I'll just tell you that over here, you're pretty much on the water table. And over here, the whole raise elevation of the field varies by only about 8 feet. And over here, you have heavily silted area, and over here, you have areas that actually are subject to erosion. And I'll talk about why just quickly as well as we go through. But I want to show you these images. Now, you can get these images for free. If you go to your SCS office or you go to your county and you talk nice to them, they'll sit down and give them to you. They have a hard time deciding whether to charge you or not, but you'll probably walk away with them. Now, here's another. This is a blow-up, and you can see the elevation a little better. And you can see there's actually this touches a small part of a lake on the back of my property. And so that water table goes underneath the whole thing. But that causes great problems over in these areas and the areas up in the front. Now, this image is, see if I can even read it, I apologize. Oh, this is the sensitive areas that the county says as far as water sensitive. So they have blocked out areas that are wet. And so if you try to run cattle through there or something, they'll be knocking on your door or try to plow into them. But it's good to know your field, and these things are there for the taking. Now, this one here is a crop productivity index. So what they've done is run their own algorithm, right? They've looked at those elevations, they've looked at the color, and they've said, oh, you know, this is a 86 crop, which is 86% of the county average, or this is 93 or whatever. And they use that for taxation. They run across, they run their own algorithm and say, okay, we've now weighted this field by it, and therefore, this is the tax statement you're going to see. And here, this is a wetland map, again. This is the wetland map, and so these are the areas that aren't touchable. Now, here's the field I'm talking about. You can hardly see. So you can see now, unlike maybe some of you, if you're from California or whatever, you're wishing you had water like that. For me, I have to manage that water. So going back, now you mentioned the areas that compaction, et cetera, the things that will show up. I can tell you that this whole field has compaction. 2 minutes. And this area here and this area here are very difficult to farm. I've been working with them with cover crop systems, and they're lightening up. Most of the compaction is gone. Now, you can look, even with the visual, where you have areas that are pretty poor. Now, you got to go out and scout, and that'll be the next section. Regrettably, we're running out of time faster than I thought, because I can tell you that there's a combination of things going on there, and what they are is relatively sandy, light soil that doesn't have good nutrition, and deer. That's the theory. I don't know that they realize they have the deer.
but also, they don't know the water.
They don't know.
So paying higher taxes and we can't produce.
Exactly. Exactly. And down in here, this area here, and see that? And up along this edge here, I have severe hardpan. I used to mold board, and I'd make it worse and worse, and the ground is like a clay, and it would actually almost pick up the front end of the tractor, and it did at times, which wasn't very good. But that's my past. And so I had developed in this very very dense soil a really tremendous hardpan, and we weren't growing anything in this entire area for probably about 5 years, and the cover crops started bringing that back. So that's, I'm talking about the maps, but know your soil, because it gives you the ability to target where you want to do work. Now I'm going to talk about, really, we're running out of time, so I'm going to go to the most important part of all. This is altitude, and you can't see much in this image. This is a very good, we flew this about 1,000 feet with an airplane, and these were sugar beet test plots for one of the large sugar beet producers in Minnesota. And they had inoculated some of these with various, with Fusarium or Rhizoctonia. And you could hardly see it in the visual, but you could if you look close. You know, you can see color variations of their strips before. You can see areas here. But when you get into the thermal, you could really pick it up. And so these technologies are useful, but you know, if you don't have accessible ability to them, get overhead and get any kind of image you can, even if it's with your son's drone, because it'll tell you things. You just have to look closely. Wrap up. All right, I'm going to go to this part of it now. That's a Google Earth image of some land I own in Nebraska, and it's been overgrazed, overpastured. And now it's a recovery project for me. But the most important thing, if I were to say, of all of this part of the presentation, there's technology out there, but you need to scout. Now, the least expensive tool that I have, and I have many, but the least expensive tool that gets me the most value in scouting, you guys all own. What do you think it is? Well, there you go. Yeah, that actually is. And nose and shovel. It is the shovel, in my mind. You know, if you don't get your hands into that soil and take it up and smell it and see if it's, you know, it's sweet, look at it. Another one that's useful, now this is a penetrometer. You go down and you see if there's a hard pan. And I'll tell you what, most of the United States is dealing with hard pan. I've seen very few fields that didn't have it. But that's a useful tool. But if you don't want to spend $150, take a piece of re-rod and sharpen it and put a board on it. But if you push down 8 inches and you hit if your ground stops and you have to push through it, your roots can't do that either. So understand what your soil is. Smell it. You know, do the things you can. We have devices like, here's the penetrometer, again, in use with one of our interns when we were down in Illinois. But this is a carbon, sorry. This is a carbon dioxide respiration meter. That's a very useful tool, but it's about a $200 tool. But you can tell what your soil's doing and what it's not doing. If you put it on a area with clover and you clean it off, it'll have a nice high respiration rate. But you put it on bare hot soil, nothing's coming off of it. You know, maybe a hundredth as much. So there's some basic tools. But what I would say is use these technologies, get what's free, use these technologies to guide you to where you want to be on the ground, because they'll take you with the GPS orientation right to the foot, or if you don't want that, you can just walk to it. You know your fields. The last slide I'll say is there's technologies, and you know of them. Providers will be showing up. The Landsat is there. Your kids probably own drones, but they're there. Yeah.
If we give you our email address, can you send us your deck?
Yes. I'll be posting this deck on this website in a day or so. The good land, all one word, .ngo, and it'll have the final section in it, and it'll also have my contact information in it. So thegoodland.ngo.
We have a couple minutes for questions.
Oh, we do.
Maybe like two questions.
All right.
So.
The answer is yeah. All the imagery is in GSIS, and there are we don't have the software, but there are softwares like I'll mention some of them in the later slides, which you'll see in the deck. But there are softwares you can buy that'll stack that, and they're not very expensive. So you can they're all GIS oriented. I do want to show you one final slide. Also, this is that same low area that I talked about on the front. After about a week ago, it rained and snowed, but ground wasn't frozen. So I went out there with my smartphone and took a picture of that very area, and that's emailed to me. So there's that was a $7 app. There's things that you can do to use as scouting tools that are just they're there for you. They're practically free. So anyway, I wanted to show you that because you want to keep records. If you go observe something, you want to keep records. This was on the ground. I just walked out there. Yeah, well, I knew where it was at because I had shown that on the other ones, but I got rushed. But now this is important because there's a hard pan under that area, and that's also an erosive area. And those are the areas that you can really get a lot of benefit with a little bit of work. So
I think there's one question back here, and this will be our last one.
All right, thank you.
Just a comment. I have a customer in Georgia that his agronomist this year, every 2 weeks, the Nassau satellites would come through and take a picture of his field. That was kind of like his tissue test. I didn't ask him how he made out, but I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's common, and that's what we did. We'd fly every week at plant right before planting and then after planting and then wait 4 weeks and fly through the whole season and so use that progressive imagery. You didn't look at it every week, a lot of the farmers, but if you're watching for disease onset, it's good to watch it every week. Now, a lot of the producers here are relatively smaller producers, and I'd say you're probably not going to have an airplane come over you. You might be able to pick up the satellite data, but you can't order its timing. If you can get a hold of a drone and just run a visual image and keep an eye on it, that will be useful to you. You'll be surprised if you're not doing it. All right. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you.